Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And let's not forget to invoke whatever spiritual exercises and or whatever you would like to do to seek more than our own assistance, more divine. But anyway, that debt is fraud. Let's dive into, because we just kind of left off in the most contested part of the 14th Amendment. Section 1 is the part that has been completely misinterpreted, and it has been redefined by the courts. And so this is probably one of the reasons why we're leaving it for last, because actually one of the things we didn't dive into is that when we look at Section 1, the very first line says, all persons born. That's what you read, right?
Yes.
And oh, by the way, welcome back, Tammy. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
So that person's right there. There is a claim by many that person's, it says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States. That means that that is property. In other words, this was the listing of persons in the Constitution, and technically persons has been listed several times in the Constitution prior to this. It's actually listed up in the Constitution with capital P and little p. And it bothers me when I'm discussing with somebody the Constitution and they go out of their way and give me the capital P, the little p, the capital S, the little s. Have you ever had that kind of conversation with somebody, because they're making a huge point out of the capitalizing? And so
no.
I understand capitalizing means, you know, different things to different people, but there's nowhere in the Constitution where the federal government assumed they were just trying to do things proper, but they didn't nail anything down that this was the very specific language, that a capital P would mean this, that a capital S would mean this. In other words, they started utilizing and people started hijacking what the meaning of that letter was. Now, I defy anybody to find in the ratification debates or in any of the debates on the 14th Amendment how the capitalizing of a letter meant something significant, other than at that time what it may have, you know, the way they may have been applying capitalization. One of the things that is significant is with the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence has a little U for the United States, because at that point in time, the Declaration of Independence didn't have a United States entity. And so little p's, capital P's, I don't think it really matters. I really don't think that there's anything there. And it doesn't really matter, because when you're talking about classifying people as property, as subjects to the government, that is a significant change. When they say the 14th Amendment created it basically subjected everybody to the federal government. No, it didn't. If that was the case, those words would have been used during the debates on the 14th Amendment in Congress. It would have said, no, what we're doing here is we're going to make all the people of the United States our property. That's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that never came out. As a matter of fact, the only time you got any type of feed or any type of inclination.
I mean, they never would have signed it if they knew if the intention was that.
Well, so to be clear, when you read the debates in Congress, all of the negative comments were coming from those, we'll call them opposers. Those people who were opposing the 14th Amendment were making these comments that, oh, this is what this is going to do. does that make in contract law, when somebody that is actually against and speaking against something, and they say something that, oh, this is what it's going to do, is, does that become legally binding if it passes? No, it doesn't.
No, absolutely not.
As a matter of fact, put it into this context. If you identify the opposers who are speaking in red, with the red font, and those that are proponents for, those who are in favor of, in green, then when you move forward and you decide to accept the contract, then everything in green becomes legally binding. Everything in red has been rejected, because those people who were opposing the contract were making all sorts of assertions, and those assertions were flat out rejected by the body whole. Now that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So when we look at the 14th Amendment, it was the same thing. And this is why I point this out. When you look at how fast the 14th, this is a lot of information that they put into the 14th Amendment. It's one of the longer amendments. And there's a lot of little details. I mean, from funding to apportionment to, holding people accountable, there was a lot of discussion. This was 263 pages in the Congressional Globe, basically 1,000 pages. And so when we look at, the process and how long it took for Congress to pound this amendment out, and remember, they hit this amendment in March, right after they overcame Andrew Johnson's veto of the Civil Rights Act. The very first Civil Rights Act, I think, was ratified and sent over, or passed and sent to Andrew Johnson for signature, so that it would become law. And he vetoed it. And so they overrode his veto. And when they did that, they just recognized that, an act does, just because they created a law does not make it enforceable unless it's derivative of the powers granted them. So they said, well, we need to actually pound out an amendment so that we actually have the powers over these very specific things, and actually make it law. So when we look at the very first sentence, the first clause in Section 1, the intent is not to subjugate people. The intent is to take all freemen and all people that have been living under the jurisdiction of the United States and make them citizens of the United States. That was it. It didn't say, now we own you. Now you become a number and you're basically, a serf. That is not what happened. So I just wanted to emphasize that one part, because we kind of glossed
over this.
They
could just add, are now citizens of the United States. Back then.
Okay. And so, and where they reside. But bottom line, when you look at the 14th Amendment, this was added much later. It was one of the last things added. This and the other part below it. For the most part, Section 1 was really just, no state shall make or enforce any law which abridges the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen of the United States, which is what we read last. The last part of this is, I think, just absolutely redundant, and then it has become problematic because of the courts. Now, when we look at how the 14th Amendment was originally put in, they did everything they could in 1871 to try to marginalize and get rid of this. Why? Because, first off, Section 3 was going to hold everybody accountable. And they recognized that as a huge threat for them to be able to do things that they have no authority to do. I mean, what's the last thing you want if you're really trying to undermine government is be held accountable. The apportionment, that was nothing, but they knew that the debt part, was already done, because by 1871, I think most all the states had been readmitted, because all the state legislatures said, we don't want to be strapped with that debt. Mm-hmm. So in 1871, when they passed the Organic Act, they were also trying to completely scrub this amendment out. And that's one of the reasons why, when you look in the compiled laws, now news traveled slow, and administrative news even traveled slower. And so when you look at the compiled laws of Wyoming, you'll notice that the 14th Amendment is not included in that book because they were already trying to tell people, no, 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 that really didn't pass. In other words, when these people took over, the radical Republicans were removed, and the British loyalists got into office to start doing the king's will and creating that treaty that was an abomination that we'll get into when we're done here with the Constitution. The point is that what they were doing was they were setting up, all the favorable things so that they could literally seize full control of the United States and the people. And so the 14th Amendment was not contested by the radical Republicans. And as a matter of fact, the few states that did contest it after they ratified it, those in office said, no, I'm sorry, we're not taking back your ratification. It is still on record that those states ratified. In other words, when the federal government allows you to change, then it opens the door for changing of an amendment. But if they didn't let you change, then they keep on record your ratification. That's it. So this is why Wiki really does do a decent job in covering it. And so you just have to do a little bit more analysis to look at the fact that they actually did pass the 17th Amendment without any southern state, coming on board to ratify. So with that, and we're looking at this concept of redefining the Constitution. In Why Counties Matter Most, I bring it up again, I actually point out how the 14th Amendment was redefined, and it was redefined, I believe, in the 1870s by the first court when they started using separate but equal. Now, go ahead and read the next clause, because we already covered no state shall make. Actually, let me ask you this, because I think there may be a lingering question. Is there a lingering question regarding whether a state can enforce a corporate law or not? So in other words, if a corporation wants to, do something that, inflict something upon their people where, they can deny their privileges and immunities that would be guaranteed. In other words,
yeah. No.
Right. So can a corporation fire a person because of what they said? Now, if you sign a contract, you come in and you have a non-disclosure, you do not disclose, trade secrets or what have you, a corporation can actually, create those types of things where they restrict your freedom of speech. But when it comes down to it, they cannot take away your liberty, life, and or what's the other?
Property.
Yeah, your property. Thank you. Those three things, they can't take any of those things. As a matter of fact, it's right in front of me. Life, liberty, or property without due process. In other words, the state actually has to have a trial in regards to a court holding you accountable for some violation, between the corporation or what have you. So bottom line, a corporation cannot actually take away your privileges and immunities protected by the Constitution. They can't protect themselves from harm, from you being able to say something or do something. As a matter of fact, they can fire you if you create, as a matter of fact, I'll give you a good case in point. There was a nurse, and I forget, I think it was Kentucky or Tennessee or maybe a little further south, where a nurse had been going in, a male nurse, had been going into a donut shop where there were some black gals that were working the counter. And he he finally broke. I mean, this guy had a meltdown, and he was in uniform, and he just went into all of these epithets regarding the race and slurs and so forth. And this was caught on video. And so the company actually, or I should say the hospital where he was working, fired him. And that became this big, you know, pushback. Yeah, you can't do that. Well, absolutely they can. If you are a, you know, an employee, you're the same thing as an ambassador for that, and especially when you're wearing their, you know, their uniform.
Yeah.
In other words, if you're out there wearing the uniform, you're almost like acting like an agent. And so we do have, you know, some responsibilities, because that's the whole point of liberty, is you have the agency and the responsibility, and you have to be held accountable. Well, when they come along, and then let's get back to a corporation trying to inflict a rule or a law that would absolutely violate your conscience. In other words, I'll give you a good case in point. Can you actually withhold money if you're paying, you're contributing for your own health care, but you're contributing into a pool, and your company all of a sudden decides to start, you know, deciding what selective surgery, such as a transition surgery or what have you, and they're basically taking money out of your pocket, can you conscientiously object?
Sure.
I believe you can. The problem is that this is being done by not the company, but an insurance entity that is driving this. And this is kind of outside of them. So I believe that you should be able to opt out so that none of your money is being used that way. And see, here's the problem. When you actually get to a point where you can actually start opting out, everybody opts out except for those few people. In other words, what ends up happening is the few people that want to take advantage of, you know, this selective surgery, well, they're the ones that are going to end up paying the brunt of the increased cost. So there's always an advantage of having everybody contribute a little bit. But when it gets into social engineering, where something becomes a conscientious objection, you know, for doing things to children or even breast augmentation, then it goes down to this thing: I should not be paying for something that is not healthcare. That is selective surgery. It's not
right.
And so, what states need to do is states actually need to start delineating, because corporations have gone crazy with social engineering and pushing America down these paths. So anyway, if you've got a question, folks, let me know, you know, how would this work or what have you? Because bottom line, what we have is we have a situation where the courts are actually going to be ruling against our rights. In other words, they don't care about your conscientious objection. They don't care about your privileges and immunities. All they care is about making sure that the social agenda is maintained. In most cases, that is the case, because that is, you know, that's the pride of a lawyer, being able to bend and change the law. Anyway, so now let's get into the next section, because nor state shall it deprive any person, that part right there, the due process.
Okay. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States.
Okay, now let's do the next section.
Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
Okay, no. Right there. So right there, that line is instituting a line that was stated where. So where is due process? Let me look it up. D-E. And so, yeah. So due process is mentioned in the Fifth Amendment. So I'm going to read it. Nor, so it says, a person can't be held in a criminal case or be held to witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Okay, so if that is in the Fifth Amendment, what are they doing that's different in the 14th Amendment?
I don't know.
Without the due process, they're basically duplicating. In other words, they didn't need to add that. Due process was already guaranteed to every citizen in the United States. Now, for some reason, somebody just said, well, let's add this. It's kind of like, you know, well, the redundancy, for some reason, people just consider, well, let's just be redundant just to make sure everybody knows. It's redundant. It doesn't change or do anything here regarding due process, because every citizen, just remember, the line above made everybody citizens, and then the next line basically says you now have all of these protections that you cannot have your privileges and immunities taken from you by any government. Mm-hmm. So why go through the redundancy of that? The next line is actually a new line. Go ahead. What's that last line?
Nor deny any person within its...
Did I lose you?
Oh.
Nor deny any person.
Nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
Okay. When they defined this, they wanted to make sure that the laws applied equally. And what ended up happening was the very first redefining of the 14th Amendment by the Progressive Court. Now, we're talking Progressive Court in the 1870s, where I believe it was Plessy v. Ferguson, where the ruling of separate but equal comes out. In other words, oh, well, if you walk into a restaurant, and there's a seat that's open, then you have every right to sit anywhere. If it's open to the public, then you have a right to sit anywhere in that seat you choose. If all of a sudden the establishment says, if you're this color, this race, then you have to sit here. And if you're this race, you have to sit there. And so that actually became a part of the separate but equal. But separate but equal denies a person their right to choose where they're going to sit in a public venue. Because even though it may be a private restaurant, it is open to the public and they cannot create rules. So the whole point was equal protection under the law. Every seat is open to everybody. If it's open, unless you have a club where only members can come in. This is where you can start segregating. You can segregate because you only allow certain people to be a member of your organization. Then now you actually have control over who sits where. Men sit here and women sit there, what have you. Then it's not open to the public and you're regulating it, and the people that are members are willing to be regulated.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're open to the public, you have a right. And that's why the whole line that no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges privileges and immunities. So in other words, if a restaurant comes along and says, yeah, we're open to the public, but you can't sit there, you have to sit over here, the state cannot enforce that because it's abridging your privilege of choosing where you want to sit in a public restaurant, a restaurant that's open to the public.
Right.
So they started going down this path, and actually I kind of cover how this was completely redefined, allowing the Jim Crow laws to actually start taking hold and start passing. And so this is where the lawyers actually started using their prowess in playing with the law and soaking it and bending it and contorting it so that they could actually use oppressive measures and oppressive laws to go after blacks and create, what I'll just say, a racial division throughout America. So anyway, what we're going to do when we come back, and I'll ask Tammy if she's got any questions regarding this, but when we come back, if not, we're going to move into the 16th Amendment, because that's the next progressive amendment that causes a lot of people angst. So we'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so Tammy, do you have any questions regarding the last parts we covered or the 14th?
I don't.
Okay. All right, so the next amendment we need to cover, because we just want to cover those that really seem to give people angst and problems. And so the next one will be the 16th Amendment. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So this is kind of short, and the language to it is pretty straightforward. So let's go ahead and hit this out of the park.
The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration.
Okay, so first off, does this change how Congress can spend money? Is there anything here granting them an open, unvarnished ability to spend money on anything they want, such as social programs, health care?
No.
No. What is this strictly speaking to?
Taxes.
Taxes. And what it does is it changes the direct tax or the duty. Because the direct tax was a duty on states based on apportionment. And so what this clearly does is it takes away the apportionment among the several states regarding census or enumeration. Or, you know, basically they're just saying that they now have the ability to just apply a direct tax on income. Now, let's go to Article 1, Section 8. And when we look at the very open clause, the preamble, the second preamble in the Constitution, which is the very beginning, it says the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. Those are the types of taxes. To pay debts and provide for the common defense and welfare of the United States. So when you look at what they're talking about, and I want to split my screen so I can actually do this. And there we go. And then I go down to the 17th Amendment. And I look at what they're talking about in the 16th Amendment. I'm sorry. That Congress will have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes. So in other words, they just changed that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes. They didn't take away their ability to use imposts and excises. They just took away the direct tax on duties upon the states. So duties turned into income. So now they're going to tax income from whatever source derives. So in other words, it doesn't matter from what source you're making income. If you're making income from multiple sources, they have the ability to collect tax on your income. Without apportionment among the several states and without regard to consensus or enumeration. So here's the question. The one part that I hadn't read yet that's a part of this taxes, this is the caveat.
It basically lays it out that this is something that has to be complied to regarding taxation, period. But all duties or income tax, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. In other words, they can't play games and go after certain people with more taxes and go after the other people with less. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, when you look at the 16th Amendment, it only changed the very first part of how they're going to collect taxes. Do you see anywhere here where now the federal government had the authority to go out and create the IRS and to actually execute these laws? Anything that changes the execution of the laws?
I don't see IRS in there.
It's not there at all. So when they actually had to collect taxes in 1792 regarding the whiskey tax, who collected taxes? Well, it was kind of simple. They had the sheriff and a marshal, a U.S. marshal that worked with the sheriff, and they went around and they made sure people just paid on their own the taxes. And so that's what they did. And when people didn't pay the tax, instead of, you know, sending the IRS audit people in, they would just send the militia in and arrest you because you're not paying taxes. They didn't change that here, did they?
No.
They didn't grant themselves the ability to create their own standing army to enforce the laws of taxes. Okay, so what we have is we have a few problems that the 16th Amendment, if it's executed properly, in other words, if it was executed by the way it was done originally by marshals working with local authorities and having people voluntarily pay their checks, then everything is fine. Then they wouldn't have to actually go and call for the militia. But if necessary, because people aren't paying their taxes, then they would call forth the militia and actually execute those laws. Because that's how the Constitution is designed to work, period. And that's exactly how they operated the Constitution when they had their first issue with taxation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so just to be clear, there's no boogeyman here in the 16th Amendment. And many people go out of their way to make claim and assertion that the 16th Amendment is a huge problem. I'm telling you that the federal government is exercising powers not granted by that 16th Amendment. People think that, oh, we need a balanced budget. No, no, balanced budget actually allows them to just say, we're going to set this amount of money we can spend. No. They actually have to say, this is how much money we need, and this is what we spend, because these are the things enumerated. In other words, when you really look at what government is supposed to be spending its money on, they actually, you know, these are the things we have these responsibilities to do. This is it. That is what they need. And so that is what they basically turn around and say, we need this in taxes. See, the problem is they want to be able to just keep, you know, they want to make a stream of revenue so that they always have a surplus. Or what they did was they actually created a deficit through spending. They kept on making a deficit so they could keep on going and amassing debt. And this whole, it's a sham. Massing debt because they're spending money on things they have no authority to spend money on, and they're taking on more debt to do it.
Yeah.
So there's no boogeyman in the 16th Amendment. Now, if we take back through republic review, this republic, there's no reason why we can't go back to using imposts. Because bottom line, we are now paying taxes to other nations. Had we maintained imposts on all imports coming into the United States, what we would have been doing was we would have been elevating our own commerce, elevating our own productivity, elevating our own products. It's a protectionism, but it was designed to make sure that we had, you know, an advantage for ourselves. We do not collect taxes on imposts. We only use imposts as a punitive measure against countries that, you know, you're not doing what we want you to do. No, the way they made money was they put imposts, and sometimes the imposts were very aggressive because it was something that was we were having a hard time, like fish salts and what have you. We were having a hard time. So they increased the taxes or the imposts on salt so that we would buy it from ourselves instead. Mm. And if it costs us more money than on the open market, because buying salt on the open market might be cheap getting it from Europe. However, if, you know, we want to, we should actually help elevate so that we become more competitive. So this actually happened, and DuPont was one that actually made it big in doing this because he learned the game of, you know, playing in the open market. DuPont was selling, I think it was borax. I believe it was borax that they were selling on the open market, and they were selling it much cheaper on the open market than what was coming into the United States. And I have no idea what the imposts were or anything like that. This is just a side story. And what the Germans decided to do, this German company decided to do, was to take borax and actually sell it in America much cheaper than DuPont's costs. So what DuPont did was they bought it all up and they turned right back around and they put it back on the market with an increase. Mm. And so they started, in other words, they took all this borax from a German company that was taking a loss by selling it so cheap. So they took advantage and actually took those losses from that other company and turned right around and made profit on it. And so they beat them, because what ended up happening was that German company basically got to a point where, you know, they stopped, you know, even trying to play a price game. And so they started going down these protections because they were at the brink of actually, you know, going out of business because DuPont played their game with them. That's what happens in an open market. But when we look at our markets itself, the impost is what paid for American debt. They hardly had, the only reason that we had debt in the beginning was because Hamilton assumed the debt. The United States already had the war debt, but he assumed more debt to allow the federal government to take more energy or to exert more energy in taxation, so that they could increase the taxation so Hamilton could get the federal government to flex its arms, which is why the whiskey tax was applied. Whoa, now we got to pay off this debt. And so it was strictly manipulation. But let's go to the next one, because the next one is the 17th Amendment. And the 17th Amendment is, we're actually going to go to Article 5 of the 17th Amendment. To correspond with the 17th Amendment. So let's go ahead and go into the 17th.
The Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state elected by the people thereof for 6 years.
Okay, stop right there. All this is doing is basically saying, it's repeating that the Senate will be composed of 2 senators from each state. So they didn't change anything there. Okay, so the next part is where they actually start making a change.
Okay, and each senator shall have 1 vote.
Actually, that's not a change. Each senator's, if you look at Article 1, this is just a repeat of Article 1. Go ahead.
Okay, and each senator shall have 1 vote. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures.
Uh-huh, okay. Okay, so actually, my bad. There is a change, and it's elected by the people thereof. So that was the one change that they put in there, that the Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state, elected by the people thereof. Because in Article 1, the state legislatures chose who was going to be the senator. So this is the change. So the term is still 6 years. That didn't change. And each senator shall have 1 vote. That didn't change. The only change is that they are elected by the people.
Right.
That's how the senators are now selected or appointed, by election of the people instead of by the state legislature. That's the only change so far. Now let's go ahead.
What's the next line? The electors in each state?
Okay. The electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislatures.
Okay, so this line has nothing to do with the Senate. So why did... This is one of my points. When I read some of these amendments, like the 17th and the 16th, I think these people were idiots because I don't think they really knew what they were doing. Why did they even add that one line? The electors is a different position, and they didn't change anything that the qualifications requisite for the electors of the most numerous branch. In other words, the electors have the same qualifications as those who are to be the qualifications for a representative in the House of Representatives in Congress. That's it. So I have no idea why they added that, and have no idea why they basically added that the Senate of the United States shall be composed of two senators from each state. Why'd they add that? All they had to do was in the 17th Amendment to really make, you know, to point out what was really different. Senators shall be elected by the people thereof, no longer the state legislature. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they needed to add there, because nothing else changed. Okay, so let's read the next in yellow, the next part.
When vacancies happen in the representation of any state in the Senate, the executive authority of such state shall issue writs of election to fill such vacancies.
No change there. Yeah, so there's no change there. Keep going.
Provided that the legislature of any state may empower the executive thereof to make temporary appointments until the people fill the vacancies by election as the legislature may direct.
Yeah, so actually the only change that they're really pointing is that it's when the governor goes to deal with a vacancy, instead of it going straight to the legislature, it's his job to actually create an election for that. Now, it also adds that the legislature of the state may empower the executive to make temporary appointments, because with the House of Representatives, if a member of the House resigns, dies, what have you, the governor has the ability to make a temporary appointment to fill that seat. The Senate, the filling of an empty seat or a vacancy, was handled by the state legislature. So the only thing that they really changed here was that now the vacancies will be dealt with by the governor, the same thing as the House, that the state legislature may actually create and empower the executive, because technically the executive would only schedule the election, right? Because that's what it says. The executive authority shall issue writs of election to fill the vacancies. So you got to wait till the upcoming election. That's when they'll fill the vacancy. They then give the legislature the ability to empower the executive to make temporary appointments. The reason the 17th Amendment was submitted and passed was because several states were failing to actually send senators. It was becoming very problematic because maintaining quorum was hard. They had a lot of progressive states by this point in time that were playing games, deliberately not seating their senators. Why? Because they wanted to shift the appointment process to an election. Now, does it say, go ahead and read the last part here.
The last sentence.
That last sentence right here, yeah.
This amendment shall not be so construed as to affect the election or term of any senator chosen before it becomes valid as part of the Constitution.
Okay, so does this change the role and or responsibility? Does this touch anything other than the appointment process and the vacancy process? In other words, the Senate will now, you know, do these things.
Yeah, no, definitely no.
It doesn't. So when you go to the fifth article, or the Article 5 of the Constitution, there's that last line. We kind of covered this before, but there's that last line in the Article 5 that actually lays out the responsibility in the Constitution for what the Senate has to do, and guarantees the state their suffrage in that Senate.
When I say guarantees the state, we're not talking about the people of the state. We're talking when they wrote this, the state meant for the Senate, they were talking about the state legislature, right? So it says that no state without its consent, no state legislature without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate.
Right.
Does this say anything about suffrage, who they're going to offer suffrage to?
No.
No, absolutely. So it doesn't touch it. So in other words, the person whoever wrote this did not even know that there was this protection in Article 5 that the state legislature could not lose their suffrage in the Senate, their equal suffrage in the Senate. They can't. It can't happen. There's no amendment that could be made that would allow this to happen unless they actually changed Article 5. They'd actually have to take that, they'd have to rewrite Article 5 and get rid of those, provided that no amendment, get rid of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would still have to go into this amendment or create a new amendment that the state, the Senate shall offer suffrage to the people at large or to the people of the state. Because in the House of Representatives, the people of a congressional district has their representation. The Senate, the representation of the people of that congressional district is done by that one representative. So when we look at how, you know, a person is to vote, technically that person in the House of Representatives, a congressman, a representative, should actually be in tune with their constituents and say, the majority of my constituents want me to vote this way and offer that suffrage. What happens is these representatives, like Harriet Hagman, goes in and she makes her own decisions. She has there's no communication back and forth between her office and the people on every issue. So that she is representing you, she's actually been, she believes she's been elected to represent herself for you. In other words, she may think she knows what's best, but she's not asking, how do you want me to vote on this? How do you want me to represent you on all of these issues, especially the dynamic ones? So the question is, when we look at our representation, whether it be in the Senate or in the House, that suffrage, when they're voting for us. They're voting for the state legislature. In the Senate, it's the state legislature, and in the House, it's we the people. So this is what really annoys the crud out of me, because I don't think people get this. I think the people like to whine and complain to the representative, but they don't hold them accountable. And as a matter of fact, I'd love to see it where we actually have, because legislative districts are so large now, congressional districts, I should say, congressional districts are so large that it's hard to have an organization, and this would be great if the state would actually do it, for like, and in Wyoming, it would be the entire state, but if the state legislature said, you know, we're going to create this committee or this, you know, this little office, this little entity that will allow you to basically look at the issues and provide guidance to tell Harriet Hagman how to represent you. Then as they actually, because the more and more people actually start getting involved in that, because people are going to start realizing, and if all of a sudden Harriet Hagman was being held accountable to what she was voting for and what she was doing, you know, now bottom line, every public servant has the responsibility to support the Constitution. So when their constituents come along and say, give us money, well, that is something I can't do. That's a violation of my oath. So in other words, there's these guardrails that keep our public servants from doing things that can cause harm. But when it comes down to how we want them to vote, as long as it's within the confines of the Constitution and within those realms, in other words, do you declare war or not? No, we don't want you to declare war. And if she votes because she's a war hawk and the majority of Wyoming says no, then that office should be able to turn right around and say, we want her recalled, and we want her recalled now.
See, are you talking about Liz Cheney or Harriet Hageman?
I'm just using a hypothetical. Yeah. I'm using a hypothetical. I understand Liz Cheney was a war hawk. She was just nothing but a problem. And I know Harriet Hageman is. But see, the nice thing about Wyoming is you only have one. I don't have to go into a segment of a, you know, small portion of people where they just represent this little, you know, a few boroughs in New York City. But if the state legislature actually did create an office for each congressional district to say, we want you to guide your representatives because they're actually giving you your suffrage every time they go and vote or speak.
Isn't that kind of what we do when we call and email them?
So when you call and email them, that's a one-by-one, and how do they really know unless somebody's organized and keeping track that over 50% of the constituents, over 50% of your constituents want you to vote this way? In other words, you better vote that way.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, so we live in a time where technology could really assist in our Republican form of government. To ensure that our representatives are living in a world where, you know, they get elected and they become these princes, they become these monarchs to decide for us. And that's not a Republican form of government. They're to represent us.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So this is why going through these things is important. But more importantly, now that we've covered the 16th and 17th Amendment, closed out on the 14th Amendment, is there anything here that really causes a problem regarding the 16th Amendment of spending money or this, you know, this progressive tax? We see that they don't have the authority to do those things. It's really not the problem. It's the way they've decided to define it and execute it, which is the problem. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I've never thought about it like that.
Right, and it's the same thing with the 17th Amendment. The way they've decided to execute, what they did was they just made this minor change, and then they went and went crazy, you know, in doing things that they wanted to do. And they said, oh, that gave us that ability to do that. And that's not true. That's why when you read the debates, I actually have the debates on the 16th Amendment. I don't have the debates of the 17th Amendment yet, but going through them, that there's really no language in there that says, yeah, we don't have to abide by the uniformity clause or anything else. It's literally just changing from a duty based on apportionment to a direct tax of any source of income. So basically lay an income tax on you. And it doesn't actually include corporations, but by this point in time, corporations actually became the beast in America, because in the 1800s, it's when the Supreme Court, a clerk in the Supreme Court, made the decision that courts, it was a little note that they put in the ruling, that corporations were like people. And that's from that point that stupid word or that stupid line grew legs. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.